Welcome back to Unfinished Business, the podcast which talks mostly about the business of design. I'm Richard Rutter, and alongside me, as ever, is
Andy Clark.
Hello, Andy. How have you been?
Well, I've recovered from my little bout of COVID. I did think that at the beginning it was man flu, but now I can justify endlessly complaining. And actually, I didn't have it that bad. But it did wipe me out for a few days.
Good one. I'm glad you're on the mend from that. COVID is never, ever pleasant.
No.
Had it a few times, not particularly badly, but it's not good. And it's still around down here in Brighton. And I don't think that's going away.
But it actually, for the first time, I had to postpone an event that I'd organised because I just couldn't. I had literally no energy. I mean, just literally walking up the stairs would completely wipe me out. So I did have to cancel an event, which I then put on last week, which nobody seemed to mind. So I'm sure, you know, if you're at death's door like I was, people will understand.
Was that the layout workshop that you did recently?
It was. Yeah, it was the layout workshop.
How did that go then? I heard good things about it.
Well, you can tell me a little bit about what you heard later on. I thought it went generally okay. Do you want to know the sort of the background to it?
Yeah, go on. I was going to ask you anyway how that sort of came about.
It was a conversation that I had a while back with Paul Boag, who is the master of self-marketing. And I've heard Paul say some very stupid things. But this was actually a pretty good idea. And he was talking about content and about putting content out across different channels. And kind of made me think that there's so many things that I like to talk about and write about that I could or should be kind of making the most use of that content in different channels or on different platforms, just so that people can, you know, get it in whatever way they want to get it. So if it's, for example, layout design, which is, you know, something that I like to talk about, then the idea is that you put it out through, you know, through an articles, or you put it out through a live event, or then you take the live event and you make a video of the same content and you put that onto Skillshare or Udemy with little snippets and teasers on YouTube. Or you might then take the script from that and expand it a little bit and put it out as an ebook that you sell on your own site or via Amazon or whatever. And I thought, what a really good idea. So I thought, well, I'll just experiment with one and sort of see how it goes. And that's what we did last week. Just a kind of a broad workshop to encourage people to think differently about layout and kind of move beyond the very, very staid and conventional patterns that everybody kind of seems to follow. And that was the first one.
Yeah, and one of our Clear Left designers went along. You were kind enough to extend an invitation. And James, you know, who was said designer, really, really enjoyed it. I mean, he's a fantastic designer anyway, but I think it was having that perspective of just really breaking out of the same sort of designs and layouts and that we see time and time again. And sometimes it's a difficult thing for us to do if we're working with a big client and we're doing everything that's going to be through a content management system. You know, you haven't really got the chance to do anything particularly sort of bespoke around any certain kind of content. You can't do the sort of creative design necessarily that way because you've got to create a system that people are going to have to be able to use for lots of different things. But I still feel like we're far more limited in what we can produce. It becomes difficult because we can produce a fantastic system that uses all sorts of different kinds of grids and where you have the ability to break out of grids and things like that, and you can hand the system over. But then you need a client who has the equal amount of imagination and time to be able to then use that as creativity as the system is, if you're handing over something generic rather than being able to design precisely the thing. But I still feel like that's, you know, at ClearLeft we get to do a bit of both, but be able to break out of that sameness that we just see everywhere is fantastic. And yeah, so James got a lot of ideas from that. James actually is, for anyone that might have heard of, a kind of a tool, a way of thinking called Utopia, which is about fluid typography that I talk about a fair bit. James is one of the architects, if you like, of that. And he and I are going to be sort of collaborating on a talk I'm going to be doing next year, actually, in March, at ClearLeft's conference Web Day Out. And it's a talk that I'm doing on trying to talk about what is new in web typography. So banging that same drum that I bang quite a lot. But it's going to be fun working with James, who got really inspired from your workshop, Andy, about, okay, let's try and illustrate these tiny little tedious typographic details through something which is actually pretty amazing and lovely, but also surprisingly practical. We've got lots of ideas about what to play with and to which sort of boundaries to kind of push there. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can come up with over the next few months on that.
Well, I'm glad James had a good time. He made some great contributions, and he made me think, actually, in some of the things that he and some of the other guys were talking about. And I've kind of had this little bit of an epiphany, which does chime with what you just talked about in terms of, you know, designing a system and then clients inputting content and, you know, whatever. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have, one of them, several, but this particular one is that we don't design the content. So you say to a client, I'm going to think of an example. Think about let's say it's the client that I'm working for right now, the Scoring Academy. And they have various different types of content. Let's say they have a piece of long form content, a biography of a composer, one of their speakers that's doing one of their events. You could just take, you know, a single column and you could say, throw whatever you want in there. And they generally do. They generally would say, you know, right, well, you know, I've got paragraphs and a quote and some lists and a table and whatever. And it's all, here's one place where you can drop it into the CMS. But actually, if you're going to kind of create something which not only looks more distinctive, but also kind of helps people to understand and to consume that content, they should be thinking about designing that content themselves. And I don't mean designing it from a look and feel perspective. I mean actually structuring the content in certain ways, looking for things that you can pull out and then style up. So if you do design a system with spaces for things, it's kind of up to them to think about things in a more structured way, where they go, what are the facts and figures? What are the dates? What are the prices? What is the trend graph? How many of these things have we sold? How many of these things are there? And it's actually that kind of content design piece which is missing for a lot of organizations. And actually, it can be quite interesting. I know we could go off on a kind of an AI tangent. But one of the things that I do quite regularly now is I will take a piece of content from a client site and I will just paste the entire thing into ChatGPT. And say, take this piece. And you know what it's like with clients? You know, they'll write 500 words and it will all just be this, you know, great big block of text. And you could say to ChatGPT, take this and produce section headings for me. And it will.
Yeah.
Or you can say, extract all the facts and figures and turn them into a table. And it's incredibly good at that kind of mundane stuff. Alex refers to it as kind of like having an intern or having an assistant that will just kind of, you know, on demand do this kind of like donkey work.
Sub-editor.
And
yeah,
there you go. It's your own personal AI sub-editor. But being able to then take that stuff, extract it, and use it to make the thing much more interesting to read and to look at is one of the kind of the missing pieces, I think, in terms of content design. And that chimes really well, I think, with your kind of, you know, system approach is content can be extremely varied and we need to think more clearly about, you know, what are the most important messages? How do we pull those things out into headlines? Because it's that stuff that you can then design. If you just think about it from a, hey, I've got a great idea for a design. You know, I'm going to have a, you know, a really skinny column and a really massive image. That's kind of like the cart before the horse. And we always talk about, you know, content should come first. But that content, if that's the case, then that content's got to be good. If the content's rubbish and not well structured, then, you know, what kind of, you know, what kind of cart is it?
Yeah. So we've had the luxury of, like, for Royal Academy of Engineering, for example, they have a publication which they send out, paper magazine, which they send out to their members, which has a lot of really interesting articles about new developments in engineering of all sorts. And there's quite a lot of creativity, or at least in visual interest, put into those, into that print version of those articles. It's not just columns of print. There are pullouts, there are images of different shapes and sizes and tables of data and all these things that add interest and support the articles. And so we created a system essentially which enabled them to replicate that. So all of those different kinds of features which they were designing into their print publication, they'd be able to do the same sort of thing for the exact same articles online. Because before, they were really, really linearized. You would just, it was almost like they cut and paste the text and take the images, upload those and stick them in at roughly the right point and all at the same size. You know, it was, that was, there was partly the limitation that they had to work with, but they've got more flexibility to do that now. Although we do find that the creativity still seems to go into the print design and it's not reflected as much as we would like to see online. And we haven't quite got to the bottom of why that is. I mean, it'll be a workflow thing rather than anything else. We think that content management system is easy enough to use, but it is, you do have to use it in a certain way that is not maybe matches the workflow that you would go through to create the magazine layout in InDesign or whatever they use for that. And you sort of see that, but so I think there's a lot of things around there where, yeah, you can the web itself isn't the limiting the factor. There's often is workflow that can be.
That's right. I think that's right. And there are lots of, you know, lots of different approaches to this kind of thing. And we've seen it with organizations like ProPublica that designed a system with their CMS to be able to add customization to a post. You know, at a very sort of simple level, you know, I do it. Jason Santamaria was famous for doing it. Trent Walton was famous for producing so-called art-directed posts. And ProPublica kind of took that a stage further. Rob Wakert did a, you know, a whole lot of work on this kind of thing. But not every piece of content, not every article on ProPublica or on the verge, actually, I think the Verge have adopted a similar approach, has this kind of, you know, unique look and feel or layout. You know, probably, you know, 95% of the stuff is all on the same kind of news template, which is, you know, absolutely, it's all about pushing news out, you know, on a very, very, very regular basis. And, you know, that's where speed is. And if you're going to be publishing your iPhone review on day one, then, you know, you're not going to be worried about intricate layouts. But if you're producing a, you know, State of the Union, or you're producing a, you know, an end of year annual report, if you're a corporate or whatever it might be, or there's a big investigative piece that's been done over months by your journalists like ProPublica do, then having the ability to be able to break out of the conventional stuff actually puts a lot more emphasis on the importance of the thing that you're doing. So
it does. And it's got me thinking about some of the work that we do with the universities at the moment. So we work with quite a few universities in the UK, and we've been talking to a couple of them around their kind of news section. So one of them, kind of fundamental things that universities need to do, is attract new students each year, international students in particular, because they get more money from them. And that's a particular thing, I guess, for us in the UK, but maybe worldwide. And looking at their news, there's kind of two things that generally goes into university news articles. It's press releases, as press releases, without really any different. And then some internal stuff like, we've just hired this wonderful new professor, and here's a new toilet block we've built on the side of the student accommodation. That kind of thing. So there might be something of interest in the press releases, but they're written as press releases and published as such. And press releases have a different purpose. They're for conveying news they're a way of communicating with journalists, aren't they? Essentially, to say, here's this stuff in a format that is familiar to you. Is there a story in here that you would like us to expand on, or that you would like to pick up on, and so on? Here's some of the basics. We can talk to you about it, or you can just take the information that we've gotten in here. So it's like it's a communication rather than a piece of publication that is really for public consumption. But the reason those press releases exist is because there's something interesting to say, particularly with the kinds of universities that we tend to work with, who often there's scientific advances and things like that that can affect our everyday. And you do hear about these things that are there on the news. They might get, like recently there was stuff around the cures potentially for Huntington's disease, for example, all over the news in a newspaper. It's fantastic. But I think if you go to look at the news of the university, you see it's a press release, and it's not what could be a fantastic, interesting article that could have a certain amount of semi-permanence. And that in itself is the thing that's going to attract new researchers to the university. It's going to attract students to the university. It's going to excite. You could present it, write it in a different way, so rewrite it for that kind of audience, and then use the tools at your disposal to actually add those interests that we were just talking about, the imagery, the data, the pull quotes, those things that just bring an article to life. And that is going to be so much more powerful as a recruitment tool than a press release. It takes a bit more effort, but it's not as much effort as the researchers have gone through to find their cures for Huntington's disease. So, you know, it's interesting there that there's a bit of pushing that needs to be done, I think. And then people finding some time, because it will take some time to do that, but my goodness, that would be a fantastic investment in time. So I was just going to finish off that you have some American universities. MIT is particularly good at this, where their website is quite brave, particularly the homepage. It just leads with their stories, and their stories are written not as press releases, but as, this is some amazing stuff that we do at MIT, and it's updated almost every day. And they have actually there an in-house team of journalists who are kind of almost like roving journalists around the university to find these stories, to feature the scientists and the researchers and all the other academics that are involved, and build up these stories and do them at journalistic levels as well. So there's bite-sized ones that are that would fit in a social media update through to the detailed article. And it, that's their focus. That's how that they show off the university, by this journalistic approach to the work that is being done there.
I've designed lots of press releases over the years, or press release sections on websites. And my approach to them is usually, well, you know, first of all, I'm thinking about the journalists on the receiving end. You know, so you get a press release link sent to you if you're in the, I don't know, the Daily Standard or whatever the organization is that you're working for. And, you know, you get a link, you click on it. What do you want to do? You want to be able to see very quickly what the thing is about. And generally speaking, you want to cut and paste a bunch of stuff. So I've designed things in a very simple, very linear way. And I've even done things in the past where, you know, I made it very clear where all the images that you can download as a press pack, or I've actually added in little JavaScript copy, you know, copy buttons next to the various sections, just because, you know, that's what journalists are going to do, because that's a particular use case. But when you think about the stories, it's a different audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can be designing for that different audience. And when you think about the professor profiles, because we want to be, you know, as a university, they might want to be hiring the best talent, or the student profiles, the student stories, those are things that are less likely to change on a regular basis. They're less likely to have, you know, 1,000 of them within a month. And we always kind of get this, you know, you always kind of get this argument. It's like, you know, well, you know, we need to be able to put things out quickly. Well, yeah, okay. Well, if you need to be able to put things out quickly, we'll design a system that enables you to do that. But not everything needs to go out quickly. Not everything is going to be very temporary in terms of, you know, where it appears in the order of the hierarchy of the content. Some stuff is going to stay around for a very long time. And if it is, and it's important, then it's important that we kind of give it the attention that it deserves.
Yeah, and you can see that in online versions of newspapers like the Guardian, where the news stories, which they have to react to quickly, within minutes sometimes, or hours, or certainly within a day. But then they have the longer form, or just a different pace of articles, the things that might go into their Sunday version, like the Observer as was, where there's no particular time basis on that. It's something that's been compiled and written over the space of maybe even a few years. And so you can see where they've spent more time and have allowed themselves to use, you know, more advanced and creative sort of templates and things to bring some of those things to life, because they haven't just got to churn out those 500 words with an accompanying image, which they've somehow managed to cobble together from somewhere to get it out, because this is live and happening now. It's something that they can spend the time on. And yeah, so you do see that.
And what I'm trying to do in what I'm trying to do in the workshop is to, first of all, broaden people's horizons and say, looking at websites is not your only source of inspiration. And also to point to and kind of refute a little bit this kind of like the web is not print argument that you hear all the time. Because, you know, there are solid lessons that can be learned from how somebody solved a problem in another medium. I mean, you know, how they solved an engineering, a web engineering, tech engineering problem by, you know, thinking about how cars are manufactured or whatever it might be, you know. And we can look at, you know, we can look at, and I talk about this guy a lot, this guy Carl Gerstner, who was a magazine art director and designer, and he created a system. He called it a mobile grid. We don't, you know, not a mobile grid that we think about, but a grid which was so adaptable that he could basically use it for any different type of content. And the variety of layouts that he managed to achieve and the way in which he would use this grid to, you know, really tell stories through all of those classic kind of design layout composition principles, you know, proximity and repetition and, you know, contrast between large images and small text or the other way around. These are all things that are tools and techniques that do work. And, you know, what we need to do, and what I try to encourage people to do in the workshop, is to say, yeah, all right, I understand that this was a fixed canvas. You know, it's a double page spread in a magazine. I don't have that. You know, I don't know what the screen size is going to be, what orientation it's going to be. But it's our job to be able to look at something and go, yeah, that approach worked, and I wonder how I could apply it to what we're doing. And the problem I think that we've had over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years or so is that people have gone, yeah, I don't need to do that. I'll just drop it into a 12-column grid with, you know, 2, 3, 4 up components and, you know, Bob's your uncle. And that's what I'm trying to do with all of this kind of content for the workshop, is just to encourage people to actually have a slight change of mindset. And somebody made a really good point. I was kind of partway through my compound grid section, and somebody actually said, yeah, but you know, you've taken a 4-column grid and a 3-column grid, and you've overlaid them and you've made this compound grid. You could do exactly that with a standard 12-column grid. And of course you can, you know, the math works. But it's not the how you do it, it's the change of mindset. And when you have these odd arrangement of grid, or what look like odd arrangements of grid columns, when you overlay two things together, it forces you to think about things in a different way. And I think that's the big point. It's about making people think differently.
Yeah, and I love that idea of that challenge. You were sort of saying you need to pose to yourself, which is, how can I make this work for the web? Or I've got some books behind me here that I was just talking to James about. There's one which I'm holding up, which is called Designing News by Francesco Franchi.
It is on my bookcase somewhere down here.
And it's unashamedly heavily influenced how I design my own blog. But there's aspects in here on the chapter pages, for example, which it just has. I'm just trying to find one now. Not that anyone can see it on the podcast, but
well, we're doing video as well if you want to watch this on YouTube.
Yeah. I should have put a bookmark in. I didn't think I was going to show this. But so here there's a chapter page, and it's got 2 columns, and some of those columns are actually of different widths, a number of different typefaces. And you've got a heading at the top of the page, and then about a third of the page beyond that is, or a quarter at least, it's just blank. It's just white space. And I love the way that layout holds together. And the challenge of looking at that and thinking, how can that work on the web? Or rather, I think the way to look at it is, what is it that I like about that, yes, that I can then translate to the web? What is it about that white space, that isolated chapter title, that I think is really powerful and works well? And then how can I make that work on something which is, instead of vertical, like most of our print stuff we see is portrait, essentially, but a lot of what we use online, well, phones are portrait, generally speaking, but everything else is landscape. So we have those challenges. But yeah, what is the essence of that that I like? And then how do I make that work in a way that can work on any kind of screen orientation and size? And that's not an impossibility. That's just a really fun challenge.
And yeah, I will remember a famous, and I forget the title of it now, but it was a famous article piece designed by ProPublica. And it had two voices. It had, you know, a victim's voice and a police voice. Talk about it in the last book. And, you know, I look at something that you just showed me there, and I think, well, you've got these indented columns. You know, every other paragraph is indented somehow and has a different typeface. So if I do want to communicate either two different voices or I want to communicate two different types of content, then that would be an appropriate use of something like that, because, you know, both the typography and the visual structure are making it incredibly clear that these are separate things, you know. And I would think that, you know, the obvious thing, going back to our university example, is, you know, an interview with the new professor where you've got, you know, Q&A, and the Q&A is laid out and typeset in that kind of alternate way, or a student interview or something like that. So there's lots of things that I find it fascinating. I was joking with our mutual friend Marcus Lillington about his pop star career, and I actually found an original 1980s copy of Smash Hits magazine that has an interview with Marcus in it. So I was going to send it to him, and then I thought he's probably got it anyway. But, you know, flicking through this article from, like, you know, 1982, 3, 4, whenever it was, you stumble across things. And one of the things that I love to do is I love to kind of, like, you know, flick through a copy of Smash Hits and go, God, I love the way in which they did their contents page. How could we use that same thing? What would it be applicable for, that kind of styling? Could it be applicable for, you know, sidebar navigation, or could it be applicable even to something like FAQs or whatever it might be? And then you kind of experiment with it and then go, yeah, you know, that kind of works okay, but I need to do X. You know, I need to have my things expandable or whatever it might be. And then you turn it into an interactive web thing rather than a static print thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where those influences are. The web isn't print, but the print has an awful lot to offer that then we can translate. And it always has done. I mean, it reminds me of Jeffrey Zeldman's, was it his first book, Taking Your Talent to the Web? It's the same sort of thing we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got a PDF of that somewhere. I don't have a hard copy of it.
I think I do have a hard copy. It might even be on the shelf behind me there, but or we might have it at work. But
so yeah, yeah. I think that the workshop went well. The way that I decided to do it was, I thought, right, I'm gonna be very unambitious with what I try to do, because it was the first one. I've done workshops in person before, but I've never done, you know, my own kind of online workshops. So I decided to do it on Zoom because they have this webinar feature, which I've subsequently learned you can configure differently than I did. And the biggest problem was that the way that I'd set it up, the default, you can't see the attendees.
Yeah.
So I found that quite disconcerting, because I would be constantly saying, is everybody okay? You know, put your hand up if you've got a question or whatever it might be. So I'll look into doing that differently. But I set it up on Zoom, and I set it up, the ticket sales were done through something called TixFox, which I noticed that Paul Boag was using. And they have what looks like an incredibly, you know, bare bones but very affordable way of processing tickets.
Yeah.
So I think the cost of each ticket was somewhere between £1 and £1.50 in terms of the processing fees. And I decided to charge £69, which I thought was a reasonable thing for 2 hours. And it turned out to be a little bit longer than that. So that was the kind of the thing for that. I would use Zoom again, but I'd configure it properly. I would use TickFox again because it worked very well. It doesn't do things like, you know, there's no facility to be able to, like, see all your attendees, press a button and send them an email.
Right.
I've been in touch with them and they said, you know, it's on the roadmap, but, you know, we're trying to keep things cheap. So, you know, there are workarounds for that kind of thing. And the way that I'd set it up was that I had a slide deck in Keynote because, you know, I'd be showing examples and, you know, different things. So I had that and I broke it down into like five sections and there would be, you know, a bunch of minutes on going through the slide deck, a bit of Q&A after that section, and then I would open up Sketch and I'd got a bunch of pre-prepared layouts where I would show people how I would create the grid. And then I had little components around the sides of the artboard that I can then just drag in and resize just to kind of show how it would be done in Sketch. And, you know, the didn't take very long for people to say, yeah, but what about responsive design? How would these things work on small screens? But I made it kind of clear that that was, you know, probably a topic for another day. you could do a whole workshop on how you adapt layouts to different screen sizes. And then I actually ran out of time. I found it a bit confusing at the beginning, switching between Zoom and Keynote and sharing, you know, doing the screen sharing properly and all this kind of stuff. So I did kind of fluff it a bit at the beginning, which was frustrating. So I didn't mind that the whole thing ran on for another half an hour, and neither did anybody else, I think. So then that was that. And then we had kind of Q&A at the end, and I would open up everybody so that, you know, that their mic was hot, so everybody could ask questions and dive into things. And then I did offer an option, which was like I was going to do on the Friday, the day after, which was, hey, it's going to be an hour, it's £29, and you can join that and bring your work and we can talk about it,
yeah,
you know, as a group. And, you know, we can look at your work and we can suggest things and we can have a little bit of kind of one-on-one. And surprisingly, actually, nobody opted for that.
Mm.
And it was an idea that I'd stolen straight off Paul Boag.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how many people did his kind of add-on. So I might try it one more time the next time I do a workshop. And then if it doesn't work, I'll ditch the idea.
Yeah, maybe people were just nervous about sharing and they didn't know who they'd be sharing with and so on. I don't know, apart from you.
So, yeah, so that was that. Would I do it again? I had a minimum target, which was like, hey, it's not worth even doing this if I only have three people.
Yeah.
So I had my kind of minimum target. I had the target that I wanted to hit, which I did, which was 20 people.
Yep.
And, you know, I made something like about £1,400 profit.
Yeah.
Which, when you consider, you know, the days and days and days I spent actually preparing all the content, was, you know, not a good deal. I could, you know, I could have worked at the dog shelter and at more. But having that content and then now being able to kind of repurpose it in different places, having that live event is something that I could, you know, run again in 3 months or 6 months or whatever. And, you know, it's just about making the most out of this content, I think.
I think that's very much the idea, because then the numbers start to add up a bit better, don't they? It's the same for, you know, conference talks and things like that, where, you know, anyone who's going to think about delivering a conference talk professionally is going to take some time doing it, piecing it together, the practicing, like doing the slides or whatever it might be. And some conferences you don't get paid at all. Some conferences you do get paid. And those ones, you know, it takes a lot of time to do these things right. And if you're putting something together that you really believe in, then you kind of got that double motivation to sort of do it at a few different places to different audiences and say, well, I want to make use of all this time I spent. Plus also I have this message I want to get across to a live audience. And so that's one of the reasons why I think you do see some of the same people coming up at different conferences, which I don't have a problem with at all. I think it's quite normal.
Yeah. I used to have one talk a year, and, you know, occasionally I would kind of just vary it, but I'd have like one main talk a year and then a backup talk. You know, I wouldn't want to do the same talk, you know, to two different conferences in the same country within, you know, a short space of time. You know, I wouldn't want to do something at, I don't know, what used to be At Media and then, you know, a Smashing magazine thing that was in London at the same time. But yeah, so that is going to be one of my kind of focuses going forward, because, you know, we've talked about, and we touched on this with our interview with Andy Bell last week, was, you know, obviously client work is not, you know, is not exactly flowing right now. So in between the client work that I do, I'm going to be working on kind of, you know, my own product.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the way forward from now on.
And it is also quite a useful, potentially, sort of piece of marketing, essentially, in its own way, albeit to a very select audience. But I know we've done public workshops in the past, like just doing teaching stuff like usability testing or whatever it might be. And you've had, say, a dozen people with you for half a day or a day learning and practicing how to do usability testing. And so by the end of that day, they come out of it and they should all be able to go and do it. But what sometimes happens is that you do get people coming out of that thing, right, now we know what's involved, we want you to come and do that for us. Even though it's like, we enjoyed it, we think we could do it ourselves, but we see that it'll be good for you to come and do that for us as well. So it can work those ways.
Paul talks about this. You know, Paul has his pyramid, and, you know, you get people in by signing up for a newsletter, and then, you know, they might come to a 1 or 2 hour workshop, and then they might go, hey, actually, I think we need to hire you as a consultant. So, you know, there is this kind of, I don't know, I suppose if you're a salesy, marketing-y person, you might call it a funnel. But that's valid. And it has worked for me. I can't think of a single time when somebody's come up to me at the end of a conference talk and said, that was great, can we hire you? But
no, it doesn't necessarily happen right there and then, does it?
But no. But I have had situations where somebody has, you know, I've had an inquiry and I've said to somebody, you know, well, listen, how did you arrive at my door? And they said, oh, I saw you speak at, you know, At Media 20 years ago. And I was really surprised. Actually, this actually happened. And I was actually really surprised that you were still working. I'm thinking, well, how old do you think I am?
Yeah. So they were actually referring to At Media then, specifically, were they?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
that was a long time ago. Yeah, that was one of the very first, wasn't it?
Well, it was literally 20 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a long time since Patrick, the organizer, has been a web person. I think he moved into film or something, didn't he?
Do you know what? I lost touch with him completely. So if you're out there, Patrick, or you know where Patrick is, let us know. But yeah, so that was that. That's been my week.
Wow, busy. Good.
Oh, I tell you what we should do is we should talk about Web Day Out.
Okay. Excellent. I will do it. Webdayout.com. It's a new conference that we're doing at ClearLeft. It's a single day conference, one of our sort of tight specific niches. We're talking about or bringing in some brilliant people and me to talk about stuff that you can do in browsers nowadays that maybe you couldn't do a few years ago, because it's not just CSS that's moving on so fast. There's browser APIs, there's all sorts of things going on. But we want to talk about things that browsers can do to the explicit exclusion of JavaScript frameworks and stuff like that. We want to know what browsers can do natively. And so we've got a whole bunch of brilliant people lined up to talk about that. Harry Roberts we've got coming in, just to think of one. But yeah, webdayout.com, and that's in March.
March of next year. Well, I'll be
2026.
2026. Well, obviously, I'm going to be checking my calendar, and I'm going to be buying a ticket. And as we said not that many weeks ago, if you're thinking about going to a conference, buy your bloody ticket early. Don't wait until like a week before. Not because it's, you know, it's going to get sold out necessarily and you might miss out, but because it actually really, really helps organisers when you buy your ticket early.
Yes, and I will add another shout out for State of the Browser Conference, which is in February, I think, 2026. That's on a Saturday in London. Super, super cheap tickets for that. And yeah, get your tickets early for that as well. I'm quite happy to give them a shout too.
Well, it doesn't just help financially with, you know, all of the obligations that the organisers have, you know, paying for catering and the venue and all that kind of stuff. But I suspect that it's a huge stress not knowing exactly how many people you're going to get until 2 weeks before. Whereas if you know about it 4 months in advance, you know, you're going to be less, have less sleepless nights anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're always having to think about, well, we thought we were going to get this number of people, so we booked this venue, but we haven't sold anywhere near enough tickets yet, and we might have to move it to a smaller venue or even postpone. Or if you've got all that kind of stress going on the whole time because people are buying tickets very late, then it's stressful, and it's quite an energy sap when what you want to really be doing is focusing on the conference itself and the day and being able to make sure the speakers are all sorted out, but make sure that all the attendees are going to have a fantastic day. That's where you want your energies focused, not worrying about, are we going to have to downsize and move it and things like that.
But, one of the things that we didn't talk about, and I think would be maybe a good topic for the next episode, is actually how we market these things. You know, that can touch a little bit on the stuff that Andy Bell was talking about with his courses. You know, you got his courses, my workshops, your events, whatever. And I think actually the marketing aspect of this could be a good topic for the next show.
Yeah, maybe we should get Dave from State with the Browser on, see if he's got any insights in how he markets.
What a great idea. Well, thanks for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed that little bit of kind of inside baseball conversation about my workshop and Rich's events. And we will see you on the next one. Cheers, bud.
See ya. Great to chat as usual. Bye.